From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, the sixth in a series of conversations with Professor Luciana Bone about the construction of the Soviet state and economy after the Russian Revolution in 1917. Okay, Luciana, so I guess we're coming up to 1929 and two major decisions that were made by the party, two new branches of activity going forward.
Right. Okay. So, let's start here. So 1929 was a very important year in the Soviet Union because the Soviet Union made the transition from Lenin's new economic policy to Stalin's radical transformation of the Soviet Union into a modern industrial economy. So this transformation this transformation required two immediate measures. Number one, it needed to create an organ within the Communist Party that would serve as a guide for the socialist economy, moving it toward accelerated industrialization. Now, this organ was created in April 1929, and it was called the State Commission for General Economic Planification, which we know as Gosplan, the acronym.
Right.
Now, Gosplan produced a report of about 1,700 pages, which outlined the first five-year plan and the plan aiming at transforming the agricultural country into an industrial country and doubling capital resources between 1928 and 1933. This plan concentrated on the mobilization of natural resources to construct the base for national heavy industry, and it incremented the production of coal, of iron, and other vital resources. It had really an astonishing success, and it forged an important base for the industrial development, the most rapid industrial development of any other nation in history. So that could be something we can talk about again in the next interview because the topic of today is the kulaks. Okay. So the second immediate measure required was the consolidation of the alliance between the proletarians and the peasants, and the cooperation of the peasants in the collectivization of agriculture,
right,
which was to be voluntary.
Right.
But this goal had one problem. This goal of consolidation and alliance had one problem, and that was the kulaks. The measure, the second important measure of 1929, was therefore on December 27, 1929, Stalin officially announced the forthcoming, quote, liquidation of the kulaks as a class.
Right. And that is one of the most misrepresented, to put it gently,
yes,
phrases in the English language as a translation, and out of Russian or perhaps any language in human translations. It does not, repeat, does not mean liquidating in the Boris Badenov sense. a single kulak or any other person, but rather the elimination of an economic grouping, like the elimination of a corporation or a guild or some other organization.
Exactly. Exactly. Liquidation is interpreted, as you indicate, as they have interpreted. What's the word? Killing.
Right.
Execution.
Yeah, the guys with the trench coats and top hats show up at your house and we're going to liquidate you. You know, that's
all lined up against the wall and shot, including with their families.
Right, that's right.
So we need to explain. Let's go first into what liquidation means. It can be a financial term, but actually it was what you said, the liquidation of challenging because it's so simple.
I know, it is.
It means the liquidation of assets.
Right, exactly right. It means that this group of people that hold this economic position no longer do.
That's right. And then the question comes in, all right, so what do we, you know, how do we proceed? How do we proceed to liquidate the assets of this particular class? Now, it just requires a little patience to follow this, because first we have to identify the kulaks.
Right, exactly. Identify them, identify their relationship with the working, you know, with the proletariat, with the industrial workers in the cities.
Exactly.
And then explain the growth of the public sector, both the cooperatives, which are, I guess, technically private sector, and state farms, as a portion of the agricultural economy, and then the decision at this point to say, okay, well, these guys that are sucking the marrow out of the agro economy, basically, they got to go, put them to work somewhere else.
Yep. So who were the kulaks? Linguistically, kulaks means fist in Russian, but it implies tight-fisted. Tight-fisted peasants. Okay, that's the linguistic. Second thing to know is that the kulaks existed in Tsarist time, and in Tsarist time you had the big landowners, the really extensive landholders, and then you had a privileged class underneath that was rich. Rich peasants. Okay, and then you had underneath that, well, first you had serfs, you had serfs, and then poor peasants. Now, when in 1918 or 1917 the revolution happened, the second order was redistribution of land. Mm-hmm. But this redistribution of land to the peasants, so the landowners fled, became exiled, joined the White Army, you know, the landowners were dissolved, really, one way or another, okay? Mm-hmm. What remained then, the redistribution of land during, which was also the period of the Civil War, was rather chaotic.
Mm-hmm, you think?
Yeah. So there was a grab, right? Landowners gone.
Right.
But there was a land grab that was under condition, not very well organized or supervised. So some grabbed lots of land and became the kulaks of the Soviet Union instead of the kulaks of the Tsar.
Right.
You know, the capitalist class.
Right.
The capitalist farmers, if you want to call them that. And then there were some middle farmers, and then those who didn't manage to grab, they were the poor peasants.
Right.
That's what happened in 1918, and that's what you inherited at the point when this class war if you want to call it that, I think it was, against the kulaks started.
Right.
Okay, so now we also, wait a second here. So we're at the point where we have defined the kulaks and their history, and how there was actually a new set of kulaks formed after the redistribution of land.
Right.
Really, land grabbers, okay?
Right. Yep.
Now, the problem we know, let me see how I can go about this. This was the history, but there's also a theoretical problem that Stalin had to deal with and explain, because Lenin, just a second here. Now, we have already said that, you know, socialism is socialism because there are still classes in it. Agreed?
Right. That's correct. As opposed to communism. That's right.
Yeah. So when the revolution happened, there remained two classes emerged, the proletarian, which was small and in urban centers, and the peasant class, which was enormous, 80% at least, scattered, etc.
Right.
Now, Stalin, Lenin, said that the capitalist, that the peasantry was the last capitalist class. But he again and again affirms for a need for an alliance between the workers and the peasants.
Right.
So the question arises, well, how the hell are you going to make this alliance if you're going to go after the peasants? But he didn't go after the peasants.
Right.
He went after the rich peasants.
Right.
So you need an alliance between the workers and the peasants. And Lenin declared, the supreme principle of the dictatorship is the maintenance of the alliance of the proletariat and the peasantry in order that the proletariat may retain its leading role and state power.
Right.
How can the proletariat become the leading role? Through industrialization. Who will help industrialization? The peasantry. There is, you know, agriculture, the collectivization of the agriculture. So, so what is meant by the liquidation of the kulak class is the collectivization of farming, which is the opposite of what the, you know, it's a positive thing. That is, we need to collectivize agriculture, and therefore a certain element of the peasant class has to go, because they're the enemy of the revolution.
Right.
So, you know, it didn't, Stalin clarified, he said, when Lenin said that the peasantry was the last capitalist class, he asked what it did mean. Firstly, it means that the individual peasantry is a special class. It bases its economy on the private ownership of the instruments and means of production.
Right.
Okay, now, that implies that somebody owns the means of production,
right,
and it certainly isn't the poor peasants.
Right.
And for that reason, it differs from the class of the proletarians who own, who base their economy on collective ownership of the means of the instruments and means of production. All right, so it also means, secondly, that the individual peasantry is a class, and here's the crux, Stalin explaining Lenin. It also, when Lenin says that it's a capital class, it means that the individual peasantry is a class which produces from its midst, engenders, and nourishes capitalists, kulak, and all kinds of exploiters in general. I don't know if you can summarize that.
Yeah. I mean, you have a few things here. First of all, you have the whole purpose of the exercise is to reconcile the theoretical with the material, which is at the basis, by the way, of a Marxist theory that these things spring from the material world, our conception of it, our perception of it, our processing of these things are all, being done inside a material, contraption itself, as human beings, but that we look at the material processes and historical processes that are going on around us and derive theory from that, as opposed to theory being the controller and being in control of the material. So,
dogma.
Yeah, exactly. That's dogma. And so what we have happening here is, at the beginning, after the revolution, the people that are looking at the need to develop the proletariat, looking at the barriers that they face, and one of the first ones being, how do we feed these people? And so you look at the condition of agriculture in Russia at the beginning, even prior to the Soviet Union, but just after the revolution, and you see huge problems. And then as they went through the developments of the NEP, of the New Economic Program, you saw the reorganization of the capitalist sector, the land grab that you describe, where you can imagine in the countryside where you didn't even really have strong institutions of state power yet and a civil war, quote unquote, actually an invasion going on from the West, fighting everywhere, that, okay, that guy over there says he can bring in 100,000 pounds of grain next year, give him the land. And you could see those kinds of, that kind of dynamic taking place all over, just to get the crops in and the food out to the cities and to be able to reproduce that in the following year. So this period from 1921 until 1929, when Stalin finally takes it by the horns, there's a period where that was first the primary driver. Then by 1926, 1927, you see that the state farms and the collective farms were suddenly producing about a third to a half of the agricultural products, up until 1929, when suddenly they were almost on par. And he said, okay, now the public sector and, the state sector and the collective sector is in a position to take over the job of feeding the people in the cities and throughout the country. Consequently, we do not have to suffer the exploitation of this group of people who we've kind of allowed to run rampant as long as they were getting food to market. And that's what's essentially happening in 1929.
That's right. And in addition to feeding the country, you needed capital. You needed to be able to also export grain that was surplus and accumulate, foreign credit.
Exactly.
Because for one thing, the Soviet Union had accumulated by hook and by crook, and mainly from Germany, enormous amounts of machinery and equipment for which they had absolutely no storage.
Right.
So, buildings, industries had to be built. So, so it wasn't just internal fulfillment of immediate needs.
Right.
It was also surplus capital.
Yeah, they had to construct a modern economy on the ashes of a feudal economy that was still smoldering.
Yeah. So let's just see. Let me just read and then parse how the BBC or I don't know which Western source portrayed this Kulak business, and then go sentence by sentence and say, no, this was not,
understood.
Dismantle it. This is a quote from, I think it's the BBC. Stalin ordered that kulaks were to be liquidated as a class. I'm reading the whole thing and then I'm going to take it apart.
Okay.
Stalin ordered that kulaks were to be eliminated as a class. And this liquidation was considered by many historians to have resulted in the Soviet famine of 1932-33. The Soviet authorities labeled the richer peasants kulaks and portrayed them as class enemies, which started a Soviet campaign of political repressions, including arrests, deportations, and executions of millions of the better-off peasants and their families in 1929-1932. Attempts to identify the number of deaths arising from the execution of kulaks range from as many as 6 million, suggested by Alexander Solzhenitsyn, whereas the much lower number of 700,000 deaths are estimated by Soviet sources. Okay, let's parse this. Stalin ordered that kulaks were to be liquidated as a class, correct. But with the caveat that liquidation means taking over their assets.
Right.
And this liquidation was considered by many historians, which historians, how many, where, to have resulted in the Soviet famine of 1932-33. Now, we're not going to spend the whole program on this, okay, on the so-called famine, because the Hearst papers went into a campaign in 1933 to portray this horrible famines. And it has been proven that they had pictures substantiating this claim taken from other famines, other places. So... Right?
Mm-hmm.
So it was a campaign by the Hearst papers to portray this in the most negative light.
Right.
Now, it says the Soviet authorities labeled the richer peasant kulaks and portrayed them as class enemies. That implies that it was all kind of a derangement of the Soviet authorities. No,
right.
They called them counter-revolutionaries, uncooperative, exploiters of the poor classes.
Crooks. That's what they call them, basically. Greedy crooks. That's what they called them. Right.
That's right.
Which, of course, offended Hearst because, the Hearst newspapers were busy protecting exactly those people here from 1929 to 1933.
Precisely. And then Stalin began a Soviet campaign of political repression. Really, what actually happened was that, yes, the kulaks were deported. I am sure there were some killings, resistance,
Right.
But the official policy, which has nothing to do with local events, right, taken on initiatives... But the official policy was take them off the land. If they don't want to cooperate,
right?
If you don't want to absorb, take them off the land, send them somewhere else,
right? Redistribute the land and have the collective or state farm start farming the land. That was the project.
That's right. So they deported them, and the law was this: they were not allowed to return for 5 years. And when they returned, they weren't allowed to practice agriculture.
Right.
Their children could come back, go to urban centers, to universities. I didn't quite check if the children, too, were not allowed to work in agriculture. It's not clear to me whether it applied to future generations. But clearly they could come back. If, they were removed with whole families.
Right.
Yeah, it's not nice, but there was no mass terror.
Right.
And as it's depicted in the Western history, they could go. Most of them remained and cultivated their land where they were sent.
Let's look at some historical analogs and start, for example, in that bastion of democracy and love that we inhabit here. At the end of the Civil War, at the collapse as a consequence of the loss of the Civil War by the aristocracy in the South, of the feudal and slave relations that existed in the agricultural sector of the United States at that time. First of all, elimination of class that the project that was undertaken here was not the wealthy agricultural class, other than those that were dispossessed and had their stuff stolen by corporate interests in the North. It was the most oppressed and exploited class, black folks, who suffer that exploitation even today, but certainly through the end of Jim Crow and several stages in between. Millions of people, let's not even count the millions of casualties that led up to 1865. And the restructuring of the agricultural sector in the United States and how it relates to the balance of the population, including the agribusiness, corporate agribusiness of today. That is the model that they hold out as an affirmative one, as opposed to the expropriation, essentially, of a large peasant class, in terms of larger holdings, peasant class, and the redistribution of that land and the sending of that class out of the agricultural, physically out of the geography of the agricultural sector, so that because they were essentially, and they had an incentive to do this as a class, there to disrupt the successful implementation of collectivization and state farming. And so
they and industrialization.
In the cities, exactly. They were, by their own choice, the quote-unquote class enemy, which means, in essence, that they had to be controlled and regulated. This is what the dictatorship of the working class means. It means that the government rules on behalf of the working people and those who are a threat to the relations that exist between working people and production are those that will feel state power. And it did not mean mass murder, but rather expropriation of this group as a class and managing their activities until they were no longer a threat.
Absolutely. Did the North supply the black freed slave with machinery? Did they set them up in collective farms?
Nope.
Did they help them to rise? Did they compensate for slavery?
Nope. Not even today.
Not even today. So, the analogs are always perfectly, imperative. Because otherwise you get caught in dogma. If you only see the flaws of the other and never acknowledge your own, that's totalitarian dogma.
That's right. Literally.
So there are other... So we cleared up that this was a removal for which the United States is not unknown and for other reasons. Stalin removed the Caucasus, what you call it, the Tatars during World War II. Right. Also removed them because they were a threat for collaboration.
Right, military.
And we did the same with the Japanese in this country.
That's right.
We have to remember the analogs in order to gauge, where the truth is.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Exactly. All right. So I think we're going to have to pick it up here next week.
And, oh, you're kidding.
No, it goes by quick, doesn't it? We've got that much done. We'll pick up the balance of the collectivization and dealing with kulaks. And then, of course, the whole thing with Gosplan and all of that next week. And Luciana, thank you very much.
Thank you, Don. Always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.